This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. My name is Celeste Quinn. Environmental scientist Daniel Botkin is our guest this afternoon on the program. He developed the first successful computer simulation in ecology, a model of forest growth. He's also worked as a journalist. He has degrees in physics, biology, and literature. His latest book is Strange Encounters, Adventures of a Renegade Naturalist. Here's an excerpt from the first essay in the book, an essay titled Maggie's Bend. Nature is many things, but it is not hypocritical, and it isn't cast in black and white. There are not good species and evil ones. The wild is wild, make no mistake about it. It is messy, complicated, hard to hike through, and hard to understand. It's dangerous and might kill you if you're not prepared and alert. Sometimes it's even fun. It's about as difficult to comprehend as somebody counting the towels in the laundry at a whorehouse in Kuskokwim, Idaho. More about that laundry in just a moment or two. Listeners, I look forward to hearing your questions and comments. Join the discussion with a telephone call. Here are the numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the local dialing area, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Daniel Botkin is a research professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and president of the Center for the Study of the Environment. He's taught at George Mason University and Yale. He's the author of many articles and books, including Discordant Harmonies, A New Ecology for the 21st Century, and Our Natural History, The Lessons of Lewis and Clark. His new book, Strange Encounters, Adventures of a Renegade Naturalist, is published by Tarcher Penguin. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Daniel Botkin, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be on your program.
Well, to begin, would you tell us about Maggie's Bend?
Well, Maggie's Bend was a whorehouse in Kuskokwim, Idaho, when prostitution was still legal, and it was on the Clearwater River at the time that the federal government decided to make that part of the Clearwater part of the wild and scenic river system. And so this presented the federal agency people, the bureaucrats, with a difficult decision. They had to condemn the land, and the question was how to arrive at a fair market value for a house of prostitution, including its capital value and its business value. And so the question was, how would you determine the day-to-day business value? And that's a little difficult, but a solution proposed by the Forest Service was to go count the number of towels in the laundry so that you didn't have to directly partake of the business. And so that seemed to be a pretty neat solution to the problem. And what I liked about this story, which is a true story, is that it's funny and people dealt with the problem in a straightforward way. And I contrasted it with a completely different kind of story. It's about a man who was the head of one of Fortune 500 corporations. And he gave a talk at a conference I gave a talk at, and he said that he had read a book about the environment, and he had realized he was an environmental sinner, and he had an environmental epiphany. Those were his words, and he had us all get up and state that we were environmental sinners and take each other's hands. And I got up with everybody else. I figured I was just as good an environmental sinner as the next person. Then he went on to explain about his environmental religion, and it turned out that by having his company recycle materials, which is what he was doing, it saved the company several billion dollars because it was so much cheaper to use recycled material than buy new material. So his religion really had a lot to do with the bottom line, but the rest of us were just supposed to understand we were sinners and not make any money off of it. And it put visions in my head of people in white sheets putting burning crosses in front of the houses of environmental sinners. I thought he was pretty scary, actually, and very hypocritical. And I much preferred the solution to Maggie's Bend, which was honest and straightforward, even if it was socially questionable.
Yeah. An elegant solution.
Elegant, yeah. Well, I thought so.
Yeah.
I don't know if the guy who got environmental religion would have thought so. It also gave me a chance to point out that you had to make an estimate of the average number of towels per transaction. And there's an error involved in that, which is part of one of my themes of the book, which is everything we do involves risk and uncertainty.
Yeah, and lots of failures.
Lots of failures, yes. Yeah, we're not very good at doing a lot of things about the environment. We do pretty well now and again, but I think mostly we sort of muddle through.
Yeah. Failure is one of the themes of this book, as we've just said, and failure to think long range, failure to measure the right things. You say we're missing out on the obvious, and I think that's what's so beautiful about the solution at Maggie's Bend.
Yeah, it was the obvious solution. And we get so caught up in our myths about nature and our wishful thinkings, and like the guy who got environmental religion with some kind of ideology, that we lose sight of the obvious. We just saw this in the fires in Southern California. I wrote an op-ed piece for the LA Times about what could be done, and you know, we are supposed to be the technological leaders in the world, and yet there's a lot of off-the-shelf technology we're not using that would help us plan ahead, reduce the risk and the damage, and help people evacuate and deal with wildfires. And we're not using it. And I talk about all the kinds of technology we could be using, and I've been trying for 10 years to get that technology used. It involves things like computers, satellite imagery, cell telephones, GPS, which I'm sure a lot of your listeners are familiar with. You know, it's on golf carts and in automobiles now. And the question is, why haven't we gone that way? And I think part of it is that we're locked into the Smokey the Bear idea about nature. Mm. Smokey the Bear, you remember, said, only you can prevent forest fires. Well, if only you can prevent them, that means only you can create them. And nature must therefore never make fires on its own. And so it's all our fault. And if it's all our fault, then we really don't have to understand much about nature. We just have to be environmental sinners and recognize our sins. That's not the way nature works. Fire is very natural. The forests and the shrubland in California that burn naturally, and the vegetation produces a lot of fuel. The plants win at competition with the other plants by putting out a lot of fuel and being able to recover from fire. So the kind of land that burns is just going to burn, and the question is how you're going to accept that kind of risk in life and deal with it.
Yeah, how do you live with it?
How do you live with it and accept it as part of your life and then reduce it? Yeah.
I want to go back to the idea of measurement, because that is something that also comes through over and over and over again in Strange Encounters. First of all, let's begin with a real obvious question. Why is it so important?
Well, measurement and knowing quantities is fundamental to the scientific method, and it's fundamental to modern engineering. Anything we do outside of what we think of as life in the environment, we're very good at measuring. Now, if you were going to get into an airplane, a commercial airplane flight, you wouldn't want the pilot to come on and say, well, we really don't have any of our instruments working, but we're going to make a guess at where we're going. And most of the people I know would be made very uncomfortable by that. I have a pilot's license, so I know how uncomfortable they'd be. It's very fundamental. And so to get ahead in our modern way, we really have to understand by counting and measuring. And it's an irony of our modern life that when it comes to nature, we're not very good at counting. We don't even think we should count. Last summer, not this summer, but the summer before this, 33,000 salmon died in a few days on the Klamath River in California because water was diverted for irrigation, and this caused a huge uproar, and I went out to run a meeting to try to get the various sides together. And the you know, 33,000 50 to 100 pound salmon are going to smell pretty bad along the shore. So it was a disaster for people. The question was, how much of a disaster was it for the salmon? And that's a simple question. And the answer has to do with what percentage of the total salmon going up the Klamath was that? If there were 100,000 and 33,000 died, that'd be a big impact. But if there were a million, it wouldn't be that big. So I asked the obvious question, and I got the usual answer. Nobody counted the salmon on the Klamath, so nobody really knew whether this mattered or not for the salmon. Mm. So that's an example of how important measurement is.
Yeah, it reminds me of the question you asked some years ago, and it was very difficult to find an answer. I don't know if you really ever found an answer. How many hours do whales sleep?
Yeah, I never did get an answer to that. And I wrote about that because over the years I've come across these very childlike questions. There's that one, how many hours does a whale sleep? And how much food and how much water does an elephant eat and drink? And when I came across these questions, I think, you know, people will think this is really silly. Why is a grown-up doing this? And why is a scientist spending money on this? But it turns out to be necessary, and then it's very surprising that you can't find an answer because the question seems so obvious. But then along the way of trying to find an answer, a lot of other strange things happen. As with how many hours a whale sleeps, we needed to know that because there's an International Whaling Commission that meets every year. All the countries interested are concerned about whaling or wanting to catch whales meet in London in Great Britain. And one year, the Japanese, who do hunt whales, proposed that they ought to be able to take a lot more of the big sperm males, male sperm whales, because you didn't really need that many males around. You know, like with a lot of cows, you only need a few bulls. And so an environmental group came to me and asked if I could determine whether it really made much difference. Well, that gets into the social behavior of whales, which is a pretty unusual thing to be thinking about anyway. And so they asked me to develop a computer model of this. We made what you can think of as a computer game with a male whale swimming around in the ocean looking for females to court. And we went to an expert on whales. At least he said he was, and he was internationally known. And he said, well, the way their social behavior works is that there's a pod, which is a group of females and young, and then there's a harem master, a male, and then there's adjacent males that are floating around trying to either push out the harem master or find a pod without a male. And so we made a beautiful little computer game that did all this and spent a year at it. We were very proud of it, and it worked for well. And then it occurred to us that maybe it didn't have to be the same male. Maybe they just needed a male. So I went back to this expert on whale behavior and said, does it have to be the same whale, or can it be just having a male? And he said, we don't know one whale from another. And so I said, I was pretty shocked, and I said, well, if you don't know one whale from another, how do you know this whole story is true? And he looked me straight in the eye, and he said, well, gazelles do it in Africa. That was the basis of his science. So it was just a myth, a story made up, and it had nothing to do with what whales really do.
Yeah.
So it's that kind of failure, somebody living with wishfulness and desire and to replace those measurements just with a vague story. That's what's very strange about this.
Yeah. What kind of myths like that are floating around today?
Well, the biggest myth is our idea about the balance of nature. Underlying our laws and policies about nature and most of what we really believe down deep is that nature left to itself becomes constant and perfect. That's why we say we like old growth forests. Old growth forests are supposed to be permanent and unchanging. And that's a nice story. The problem is that it's wrong. And the last 30 years of environmental science has made it very clear that nature's always changing. even some of the biggest and oldest trees that we identify with living forever or living in this kind of constant world need disturbance. Sequoia trees and redwood and Douglas fir, they have to have fire to regenerate in a natural situation. And if you don't allow fires to burn, then you don't get new trees. So change is very natural. We have to adjust to that. That's the biggest thing we have to adjust to.
Yeah. This is a lesson. It's very interesting that you mentioned that you talk about that, because in the at the end of the book, there is an essay titled Thoreau's Transit. That's something that Thoreau wrote about, how nature is dynamic.
Thoreau understood that, and Thoreau isn't, it's interesting, isn't what he is cracked up to be. Everybody, both pro and anti-environment, quote one statement from Thoreau. He was a pretty good sloganeer. I think he would have been a good advertising man, probably better than he was a writer. He said, "In wildness is the preservation of the world," and everybody has taken that to mean that nature's good, people are bad, we want real wilderness everywhere, and that's not what he thought at all. He meant something quite different. And he was a very interesting person, a good model for what I'm talking about, in that, first of all, he was like a person from Missouri. He never took anybody's word for anything. If somebody told him something, he'd think about it, but then he'd go off and try to see if it was true for himself. And so he went to Cape Cod, and the people there told him that the sand of the Cape, which, you know, it is sandy soil, actually moved. It was pushed by the winds and the ocean, and that there had been a boat that had been, a small boat that had sunk and been buried by the sand on the leeward side of the Cape. And a number of years later, it turned up on the windward side, so the Cape had rolled over it. And he got very interested in the idea that even the ground was moving. Nature was really dynamic. But he didn't accept what they said. He went out and started to measure it. He went and talked to a lighthouse keeper who had lived there for 60 years. That impressed him, and had a lot of his own information. But then Thoreau, who was actually a surveyor, made a surveyor's transit by borrowing some equipment from a carpenter and measured the angle down from the top of the dune to the bottom, and came back the next year and measured it again and got an estimate of the erosion rate. And he said that in a certain number of years, he gives the number of years, the lighthouse is going to fall into the sea. And actually, this century, that lighthouse has had to be protected and is being protected against falling into the sea. Mm. So he, again, it's the idea that you start off with this person who is idealized as the romantic about nature. But when you dig a little deeper, you find that he's a skeptic. And what does he do? He measures. And he looks and observes very carefully. And that's a lesson we need to learn when it comes to environment.
Yeah. Let's talk with a listener, a caller waiting for us on line one in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. This is a very interesting conversation. Your discussion about Thoreau actually brought up something interesting that I had read once, that during his time in Walden Pond, I think he burned quite a few acres of woods just starting cooking fires. I mean,
he did start a fire. It upset the local ladies.
Oh, is that what happened?
Uh-huh. He did start a fire. And the other thing he did that upset the local ladies at Walden Pond was he invented raisin bread. So when you buy raisin bread, that's a Thoreau invention. He was actually an inventor. And I guess he got bored with bread. He was pretty imaginative, so he decided to throw in some raisins, and that upset the local.
That's interesting. The whole breakfast industry is all different. But I actually had a different question, and I'm going to try to frame it because it might be a little too overarching, but it has to do with maybe a culture's overall theological worldview and how it impacts our environmental policy. In the U.S., for example, you know, we have a fairly more conservative religious tradition, and there's fewer people who believe in the mechanism of adaptation through selective mutations, advantageous mutations, which is often called evolution. They have more of a special creation bent, and they believe that it's a more personal aspect of nature, that God created nature for us. And I think in Europe, it's a much more secularized society, and I think there's a lot more empiricism in Europe regarding nature. And I don't know what the different environmental policies are or in Europe. I have an idea in America. How does that kind of worldview, maybe overall in a culture, how does it affect our environmental policy? Does it go into the whole aspect of when you were talking about the environmental center versus the other case of the place in Idaho, the brothel in Idaho?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Is there a relationship there?
Our ideas about nature are very heavily based on culture and religion and myths. As long as people have written in Western civilization, they have written about nature. And there's three classic questions. One is, what is nature like undisturbed by people? And that's modern, translated into our modern terms, that's what's wilderness? And then, what is the effect of nature on people? And we ask that all the time. How important is it for us to have contact with nature? And what is the effect of people on nature? And, of course, that's the whole modern environmentalist question. So these questions have been asked over and over again. And also what you're referring to, there has always been a great amazement and wonder at the diversity of life on the world and in the world and the wonderful adaptations of creatures to nature. And, of course, before science, the only explanation was that it must have been made by the gods or a god. So it is very much part of Western religious tradition. And what happened in the Middle Ages and in the Renaissance was that it was starting with the Greeks as well, the world looked perfect. You assumed that the gods or God who was perfect made it, and therefore it had to be perfect. And so then you're stuck with the question, if it has to be perfect, why do we find it imperfect? And the Western civilization tradition, once you buy into the balance of nature, which does have this religious and cultural basis, once you buy into that, then you're stuck pointing the finger at yourself. And that's the classic answer for 2,000 years and more. Why is nature not perfect? It's because we've messed up. Either we are supposed to be the final cog in the mechanism that runs the earth and we're not doing our job, or it's perfect without us and we mess it up. Mm. That's basically the same answer we're getting today. Of course, we have had huge effects on the environment. I, having worked to try to help the environment, I'm well aware of that. But we've gone so far overboard in recognizing how badly we've done that we fail to understand that we really are part of nature. And we have to think of ourselves inside of nature in order to really solve the problems. Mm. So, yeah, these are deeply cultural. They're so deeply cultural. That's how I got involved in all of this. I started working on marine mammals, giving advice to the U.S. Government Marine Mammal Commission in the early 70s. And I realized that other scientists were giving them advice that they truly believed that I knew they knew were contradicted by facts. And I got puzzling about why they would be telling people something that contradicted what they themselves knew. And they weren't charlatans.
Yeah.
They were so caught up in the myth of the balance of nature that they couldn't even see their own facts. And most of our laws about nature are balance of nature laws. So, yeah, the first thing is to recognize how deeply cultural all of this is and how it goes beyond the scientific information. That's why it's so important to observe and measure.
Mm. Well, thank you very much. That was very interesting.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other questions, comments are invited. Daniel Botkin is our guest this afternoon. He's an environmental scientist. His latest book is Strange Encounters, Adventures of a Renegade Naturalist. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Maybe to follow up on our listener's call this afternoon, the first listener to call in, you talk with us about chance and the monkey's dilemma.
Oh, yes. Well, yeah, that's a story that I really liked about how risk is really part of our lives. I was doing some work in Costa Rica about forests, and we were taken into the tropical rainforest by a strange character himself, but he took us out and in the rain for quite a long walk through the rainforest, and he brought us to a small palm tree that grew underneath the tall trees. And the leaves on these trees are about a foot and a half long, and they made a natural angle, a downward V. And he showed us that there had been a cut, like someone had taken a knife and cut halfway through, and that made it the leaf into a four-sided cover, like a little tent. And he said that there are bats that like to build their nest under this big leaf because it protects them from the rain, and they take their fingernails, essentially, and cut halfway through the leaf so that it makes this nice little tent cover. And then there are monkeys who live in the Costa Rican rainforest that like to eat the bats, but the bats only use a nest under a leaf for a few years and then leave. And wasps like to come along and build their nests using the bat nest as a base, you know, hanging down. Now, if a monkey comes along, if he peeks underneath to see whether there's a bat there or not, the bats are so fast that before he can do anything, the bat's gone. So the monkey's dilemma is that if he comes across one of these cut leaves, whether he should reach under it and grab, and he's either going to get something good to eat or he's going to get stung. And there's no way out of that. And what I'm trying, one of the things I'm trying to say is that everything we do about nature involves risks, and it's that kind of risk. We can never have a perfect solution.
And that is, it also illustrates how we're all in the same, boat.
We are. Yeah. I also told a story about avoiding deer in the fog. I had a friend who was an expert in New Jersey for managing deer. And so he really did know a lot about deer. And he was being driven along the coast near Atlantic City by a friend, and it got very foggy so they could barely see ahead of them. And a deer dashed across just in the headlights right in front of the car. And this expert on deer turned to his friend who was driving and said, "You better slow down. Where there's one deer, there's likely to be others, and another might dash across the road." So his friend slowed down, and a deer ran right into the side of the car. Mm. What that means is that if he hadn't slowed down, the deer would have missed him by going behind them. And so there was nothing wrong with this person's knowledge. It's just that there's always risk and uncertainty in life. You can win a lot of the time, but you can't win all the time.
Yeah. Well, at the same time, this says a lot about the beauty of the natural world and the wonder that it holds for us.
Well, that's why I've been out in nature my whole life. It is wonderful, and you do get a lot of wonder at it. And I find the more you look at it, the more wonder you see in it. Henry David Thoreau found that, too.
Yeah.
He could look... He could walk a little way from his house in Concord and get a spiritual feeling about being close to nature. He didn't have to go to big wilderness far away.
Yeah. Well, back to that essay, Thoreau's Transit, I think it could also be titled Huber's Transit. Maybe you'd tell us about Parker Huber.
There's a very wonderful man named Parker Huber who lives in Brattleboro, Vermont, and he has walked everywhere that Thoreau has walked and canoed everywhere that Thoreau has canoed. And he was our guide. He's a very gentle person who really loves nature. And we wanted to follow where Thoreau went to see how it had changed. Just getting back to this idea of how much has nature changed. And along the way, we got talking. We were in a canoe, canoeing a day and a half, and it was drizzling. And Parker and I were just talking about what it was like. And he said, you know, what do you really get out of being in nature? And he said, well, it's very hard to explain, but I like going out there and just experiencing what it is, whatever it is, that I come back and I get a kind of spiritual renewal from this. And so it meant very deep things to him, and yet he also appreciated the importance of science and measurement. It's a duality that we really have to work on in our society. We live in this wonderful scientific society, and we're not sure how science and our personal experiences fit together. We haven't worked that out. We don't really know where we fit with nature. We know so much information, but we don't, as I said, we don't measure the right things. But I think we're the first civilization to be really confused about how we fit in with nature. And that's what I've tried to pursue. And in this book, I'm trying to talk about that by telling funny stories and poignant stories.
Yeah. Well, in my own experience, there's a place that I like very much to hike. And there's a guide to a number of trails in this location. And the hiking is beautiful and wonderful. But the guide, of all things, it tells you, and this is useful information, but I'm still not quite sure if I like it being there or not in the guide. And that is how long it will take you to get from point A to point B on the trail.
You'd kind of not want to know, just discover for yourself.
Yeah. And why, you know, it's useful information because if you want to get back by dark, for example, that's helpful to know. On the other hand, it's like, well, how can you, I might go very much slower than the person who clocked this trail. I don't know. I'm likely to stop often.
Well, I think part of what you're saying is nature is many things, and it can be different things to different people. There are different kinds of wilderness areas. There's a wonderful wilderness area in South Africa called Tsitsikamma. It's right along the coast, and you go in there, and nobody ever comes after you. They want it to be a true wilderness experience, and they just let you go. We have a hard time with that because we think we need to save everybody's in trouble. But if you want a really true wilderness experience, then you want to be left alone. So I think what you're saying is that there's a nature that satisfies you is a little different from the nature that will satisfy the next person.
Yeah.
We have to get used to that kind of multiplicity, too.
Yeah. Well, and I suppose somebody might be hiking those trails as a matter of, you know, vigorous exercise. So their desire would be different than mine as well.
Well, I've been a scientist, and I have a pilot's license, so I always like the numbers.
I think they're
helpful to me.
You're measuring things.
Right. Yeah. And I can gauge how it's going to be. It doesn't really interfere with whether I do it.
Yeah. One of the delights of this book, Strange Encounters, is to ponder how nature affects every nook and cranny of our lives. This fall, you know, we were treated to a spectacular fall classic, the World Series and the battles for the American and National League pennants. And in the book, there's an essay that got me thinking about baseball very much and nature. And what if those games had been played with aluminum bats, you know? Not the same thing at all as the game with the wooden bat. How is Major League Baseball affected by the need to conserve nature?
Well, Major League Baseball uses wooden bats, and essentially all the bats are made of white ash. That's because it has a really wonderful straight grain that's just perfect for bats. And nobody farms white ash. They go out and hunt and gather it. And white ash grows down by streams, and it likes very fertile soil. The best white ash for baseball bats comes from Pennsylvania. There isn't that much land available to it, and the major leagues use several hundred thousand baseball bats a year, and so I calculated how many trees that would be and how much of a forest area you would need in order to supply baseball bats for the big leagues, because we don't know if that's a sustainable product. And if you were to run out of good wood for baseball bats, then you'd be stuck with aluminum in major leagues. And I've been a baseball fan all my life. I think that would really be too bad. So I made the calculations, and then I said, well, I don't know how much the land would cost, but let's just say it would cost $1,000 an acre. I figured out that for $20 million, you could buy enough land that would be good for growing white ash, that you could have a sustainable supply of baseball bats. And that's within the salary range, you know, one of the 3 or 5 year contracts of a star in baseball. So you can have one more big league slugger, or you can have a sustainable supply of Louisville sluggers. And the question is, which do we want? And personally, I'd rather have a sustainable supply of baseball bats. That was a fun essay to write, and of course, you know, I was interested in the baseball bat problem itself, but underlying it is if you start thinking about how you're going to provide baseball bats, then you start to understand what's become a very popular term, which is sustainability. Hmm. How do we sustain the world and its resources and ourselves?
Very interesting. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Daniel Botkin, our guest this afternoon. His latest book, Strange Encounters, Adventures of a Renegade Naturalist. We've got about 10 minutes left in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. If you'd like to join us with a question or a comment, now's the time. Give us a call. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Since no one is waiting to talk with us, no listener is waiting to talk with us at the moment, I'm going to ask you a big question that kind of pulls together a couple of different essays in the book. The lessons of the radioactive forest, the exploration of space, and the art of war.
Well, I guess your listeners don't know about either any of those. I worked in a intentionally irradiated forest, and I wrote about it. During the Cold War, there was a concern about a thermonuclear war, and so the then Atomic Energy Commission set up some major experiments. One on Long Island at Brookhaven National Laboratory, they irradiated a forest with as large a source of radiation as they could bring in. And I worked out there, and when Dick Cheney came out with his energy policy and started to talk about how we really needed to go back to nuclear energy and had to go back to huge grids, increase the big power lines and the big grids and provide a lot of money for coal and keep depending on oil, I started talking to my friends in economics, and they, too, believed that nuclear power was in the future and that wind and solar were not very much in the future. The facts are just the other way around. The main radioisotope used in nuclear energy and power plants, if it were used worldwide to provide something like 40% of the world's electric power, we would run out of known reserves of that in 30 years. So that's not a sustainable source of energy as we now make nuclear power plants. And I had another friend who was on a committee to determine how you would set up a warning that would last 10,000 years for warning people where they're going to dump nuclear waste. Nuclear power has never really paid. It's been very expensive, and wind and solar are cost competitive. They give you the option of being on the grid or off of the grid. There's lots of wind and solar energy, but people in our society haven't really bought into that. So I decided this went beyond facts, and it had to do with our feelings. And so the best thing to do was just to write about what it was like to be in an irradiated forest. It started as an op-ed piece in the L.A. Times, and they were interested in it because it was a very creepy place to be. It had been irradiated for 7 years, 20 hours a day. They put the source underground for 4 hours a day, 4 hours a day, so you could go out and work in it. They put it under lead shielding. And after 7 or 8 years, you'd go in, and it looked like it just burned the day before because it was sterilized. So it was a very strange place to work. And what I was trying to suggest is that that's not a world we want in the future, and we have to start with our emotions somewhat because we are operating from them, and we have to get to the facts by first confronting our emotions. So that's what I was writing about when I wrote about the irradiated forest.
Yeah. There, in this, in that essay, there's a young woman at the time who wrote a paper about the effects of pollution.
Oh, well, yeah, that was a great irony. Berkeley National Laboratory is one of the big national laboratories in the United States, if that's not familiar to your listeners. And they do lots of kinds of research. And when I was doing research there many years ago, they were very careful in dealing with radioactive waste. But when it came to non-radioactive chemicals, they just poured them all in the same containers, meaning you had all kinds of chemicals you didn't really know what they were anymore, reacting with each other. And then they dumped these into the water table, just into the sandy soil of Long Island. And the water supply in Long Island is a lens of floating fresh water in the groundwater. So they were pouring toxic chemicals into the groundwater. And this young woman, who was a graduate student, got curious about this and wrote a paper about it, pointing out that there was a possible environmental danger from doing this. And her work was poo-pooed and dismissed. But about 10 years ago, the people running Brookhaven started very quietly to buy up houses around the laboratory. And then it came out that actually carcinogens had been moving from the laboratory's wastes into the groundwater and into the water supply for houses around the laboratory. And this young woman had been right many years before. It ended up with the people running the lab being fired and a big change. It's another one of those funny contradictions that the people running that laboratory were so focused on one kind of pollution, they didn't see the big picture. And they couldn't believe they were making any mistakes in something they thought they knew about. So there's a lot of lessons in that. You got to be very careful. You have to not lose sight of the big picture.
Yeah. They poo-pooed her work. They called it amateurish.
Amateurish, yeah. And it, you know, it may have been because it was the work of a graduate student, but what they didn't do is listen to the underlying message in it. The same thing happened out west. A similar thing happened at Hanford Nuclear Power Plant, where the that's one of the places that atomic weapons were developed, and they have plutonium, and they were mixing radioactive material and non-radioactive chemical waste together. And this is much more recently. A woman blew the whistle on them, and they tried to get her fired. She said the tanks they were holding the material in were corroding because of the acids from the non-radioactive material, and it turned out in the end that she was absolutely right. So now there's a huge cleanup. So these places that were supposed to be isolated government laboratories to develop nuclear power and nuclear weapons and to keep them isolated turned out to be run in a way that did not protect the public. If there's some important lessons in the background, it means you have to be a little bit like Thoreau, always be a little skeptical, try to find out answers for yourself, make sure somebody's counting and measuring, and try to cut through your own cultural beliefs.
Yeah, that's a tall order, though.
Yeah, it is, and what we mostly do is kind of muddle through. And what I tried to do in my book was to talk about all this, but have some fun. You have to keep your sense of humor and tell funny stories and tell poignant stories about it to get people in a better mood to think about it.
Mm. Daniel Botkin, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you. Nice talking with you.
Daniel Botkin has been our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. We've been talking with him about his book, Strange Encounters, Adventures of a Renegade Naturalist. The book is published by Tarcher Penguin.